This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And dozens more. For a 10-day festival pass or ticket info, visit fertilegroundpdx.org or go to kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Portland premiere of Who Bombed Judy Berry at the Clinton Street Theater, Wednesday, February 13th. The film will play at both 7 p.m. and 9:15. This new documentary covers the 1990 bomb attack on two Northern California environmental activists, which still remains unsolved. The film is a compelling tribute to Berry, a fiery speaker whose background as a union organizer put her in a unique position to bridge the cultural divide between forest activists and rank-and-file loggers.
I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe.
Again, that's Wednesday, February 13th at the Clinton Street Theater. More information may be found at kboo.fm/Berry2013.
Up next, we hear an excerpt from the program Economic Update, hosted by Professor Richard Wolff. Here he speaks with Professor Jan Raymond about his Gramscian analysis of the Occupy movement.
I want to welcome Jan Raymond.
Thank you for having me.
Jan is a professor who teaches philosophy and social theory at the Union Theological Seminary, a very old and well-established theological school in New York City. And he also teaches at the Free University in Berlin. He's written many books and articles, and the most recent, which will become available later this year, is called Theories of Ideology, and the publisher will be the well-known Brill Company. Today I've invited Jan Raymond because I want to discuss the impact, particularly on the American economy, but on American society in general, and perhaps more globally around the world, of that remarkable phenomena, Occupy Wall Street. It's a good year now that it exploded onto the American scene, so we have time to look back and think about it. My guest, Jan Raymond, is someone who studies it, who has published articles about it. He's involved with a German political party called the Die Linke and with its intellectual think tank called the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation that has also devoted a lot to looking at the Occupy Wall Street movement here in the United States. They even had a conference on it recently, and also to compare it to movements for social change, to movements against austerity that exist in Europe and beyond. And finally, I've asked Jan Raymond because he has a particular perspective I think you will find interesting. He applies the work in his own studies. He applies the work of a major 20th century social theorist named Antonio Gramsci. And so by final introduction to him, I want to say a few words about Antonio Gramsci. Very widely influential across many disciplines in the United States, in Europe, all over the world, people study the writings of Antonio Gramsci. He is arguably the most influential Italian social theorist, maybe ever, but certainly of the last 100 years or more. He comes from a very obscure place, the island of Sardinia. He grew up in a peasant family. He was very sickly. Indeed, he had a kind of a bent body all his life, a small bent man, who tells a famous story that his parents didn't believe he was going to live. And true to the traditions of the little Sardinian town, in his early months, they had him sleep each night in a coffin because they expected him to die. He went on to become an intellectual giant, far outdistancing his physical infirmities. There is today, for example, in Rome, the Gramsci Institute, one of the most important intellectual centers of thought in all of Italy. Less well known, because it frighten some folks is the fact that Antonio Gramsci was for a long time the founder and the longtime head of the Italian Communist Party. And indeed, shortly after Benito Mussolini became a leader in Italy in the early 1920s, one of his first acts was to arrest and imprison Antonio Gramsci, who, as a communist leader and as a leading intellectual, was the sworn enemy of fascism as it was represented by Mussolini. Mussolini put him in jail, where he spent the rest of his life. They only let him out in 1937 when he was so ill that he had a very few months left to live, and he died. While he was in jail, he decided to think through what a revolution in Italy might mean. He produced a famous body of work, usually known as the prison notebooks, that were the product of his work there, and that's where his influence comes from. So I think you will find it interesting to see how someone applies this great theorist's work on something as urgent and topical as Occupy Wall Street and all it has meant. So, Jan, let's begin by having you tell us, if you can, what in the world is meant by a Gramscian approach or a Gramscian analysis of anything such as Occupy Wall Street?
Antonio Gramsci was the first theorist who systematically investigated the question of how a class society succeeds in establishing a hegemony, which means a general consensus that its rule is legitimate and beneficial. How can it maintain this consensus despite capitalism's obvious inherent irrationality, despite its recurring economic crisis, despite its polarization of rich and poor, despite its destruction of the environment? And Gramsci also asked how the lower classes could disrupt this imposed consensus, how oppositional movements could develop what he called a counter-hegemony, an attractive and appealing alternative to the power that be. And I think that these are still the most important questions when we deal with a movement like Occupy Wall Street. A Gramscian approach can account for both Occupy Wall Street's strengths and weaknesses. It looks, for instance, at how the movement was able to disrupt the predominant ideological framework of U.S. capitalism, how it captured the imagination of many people that had not been involved in progressive politics before, how did it tap into people's common sense and frustration and discontent, and on the other hand, how can we understand the limits of the movement that blocked the construction of a political alternative and a sustainable counter-hegemony so far.
But let's begin by having you tell us how you think Occupy Wall Street was able to change the common sense of Americans, in the sense of how it changed the way they looked at the economic system they lived in, how it changed the way they understood it, and was that change deep? Did it change it in a profound way? Tell us how you think Occupy Wall Street worked its effects on people's consciousness.
Okay, to start out with, this achievement was certainly not stable so far, or is not stable so far, not a lasting one. But in order to appreciate the enormous achievements of the movement, we have to go back and compare what was before and what was after it started. We have to remember that up to mid-September 2011, it seemed to be set in stone that the Tea Party, the only vibrant and expanding social movement in the U.S., and we all remember that when the Obama administration organized a huge bailout for the big banks and financial institutions, and then turned over economic policy to Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and so on, it created a huge frustration and discontent and dismantled its own social base. And since there was no leftist formation in any independent way, this terrain, this discontent was immediately occupied by the right-wing Tea Party movement, which tapped into that frustration and redirected it from Wall Street to Washington against the government, against government's regulation, against government's taxes, and so on. It was pretty
carefully
successful.
Carefully avoiding any critique of the economic system.
Sure. Against the cultural elites instead of the economic elites, for instance.
Yeah, very interesting.
So liberals and leftists could not imagine that a mass movement like Occupy Wall Street could emerge and develop in such a short time. One month later compared to September 2011, the hegemonic landscape has changed considerably. According to a poll of late October 2011, 43% of U.S. citizens agreed with the views of the Occupy Wall Street movement, compared to 9% approval ratings for Congress. Mm. So this was obviously a huge shift in a very, very short time period.
And it suggests, right, I mean, that the change in mentality must have been building implicitly or maybe even below the level of consciousness so that this Occupy movement was able to bring it forward in people's minds, to make it legitimate, just the kind of Gramscian notions.
Yeah. The main causes, there are many reasons why Occupy Wall Street was successful. I limit myself to just some of them. The first reason is that at the beginning, by occupying Zuccotti Park, the movement showed a combination of boldness, creativity, and inventiveness that captured the imagination. People could also see then in the following weeks that these folks actually had the courage, the chutzpah, to stay there, to persevere against all the odds. A second reason is that from the outset, Occupy Wall Street built relationships with community groups, with anti-poverty initiatives, with immigrant rights organizations, church communities, and so on, and not least with trade unions. For example, it sent its activists to the headquarters of the telephone company Verizon to show solidarity with the communication workers' strike. And in response, several trade unions showed their solidarity with the movement as well and picked up slogans of the Occupy movement for their own struggles.
And it's quite clear for those who don't remember that the first failed attempt of Mayor Bloomberg to vacate Zuccotti Park was prevented when a ring of union members surrounded the park and confronted the mayor with a requirement to violently overthrow the unions that he needed for his political life to continue. Was a very important moment of solidarity that kept Zuccotti Park occupied by Wall Street for weeks beyond what would otherwise have been the case.
Yeah. And I think this is due to a very clear anti-sectarian approach of Occupy Wall Street. So they created relationships to other movement initiatives, relations of mutual reinforcement, one could say. And a third reason is that they, especially by their slogan, "We are the 99%, they created a new framework of unity, common belonging, that stood out against the long U.S. tradition of single-issue movements.
And identity. Issues that kept away from the economic.
Yes.
Whether they were anti-racism or anti-sexism or in favor of the environment, they were riven by debates, usually won by those who said, don't bring up the economic questions. It will hurt us. It will divide us. So Occupy Wall Street is absolutely extraordinary in putting the economic inequality and oppression right up front from the beginning.
Yes. I mean, I want to stress that all these subjects, ecology, racism, are very important subjects.
Absolutely.
This is not the point. The point is that identity politics is often based on a kind of distinction from each other. And I think that this slogan, "We are the 99%, created a completely new framework just by expressing an undeniable economic fact of inequality, immediately confirmed by the Congressional Budget Office, namely that over the last 30 years, the top 1% more than doubled its share in the national income, whereas the other segments went down. And this is an enormous creativity to just translate that into a political slogan.
We're talking with Jan Rehman, a teacher at the Union Theological Seminary, as well as the Free University in Berlin. We're talking about Occupy Wall Street, and he is telling us about his thinking and research as to what its impact was, and now we want to talk about some of its limits. So let me begin, Jan, by saying what everybody says, which is it is much less in the public eye, much less in the media, much less in evidence in our lives today than it was in those final months of 2011 and even into early 2012. So some of its momentum is lost. It certainly still exists, and it's active in a variety of ways. In the New York area, it was stunning what the Occupy movement was able to do in helping people recover from Sandy, the hurricane that we had here, where it did more good than most of the city agencies that should have been doing the work. But tell us, how do you see the limits, the things that Occupy Wall Street did that teach us things it ought to have done, or at least that the next incarnation, the next upsurge, ought to remember to do?
Yes. Before I point out the limit, I would like to stress that Occupy Wall Street has not vanished. After the clearing of Zuccotti Park, it lives on in many actions and campaigns, for instance, against student debts and foreclosures, Occupy Our Homes, and so on. And you cited the example of Occupy Sandy. I think what is so difficult for the movement is to find another point of coalitions and of visibility.
Now that they've been pushed out of the park.
Sure, sure. And the police takes care of that. That is not to be happening again.
Yes, the mayors seem to have been nicely coordinated from Washington to do that all at the same time.
Exactly.
To keep the parks clear. I cannot miss an opportunity to remind our listeners of what the mayor of New York said. The mayor of New York said he had to do this, violently bring bulldozers in and destroy the camp of Occupy, because of his deep commitment to cleanliness. You see, the park wasn't clean enough. This is the mayor who presides over the filthiest subway system on this planet and has throughout his three administrations. He doesn't care about what they look like or their dilapidation. He's interested in cleanliness, but in a remarkably selective way. So, Jan, I interrupted you. My apologies. Tell us about the limits.
I think what's missing in the U.S. is an independent leftist formation that is both open to the many different approaches in the social movements and sufficient coherent to bring these differences together and to translate them into a convincing alternative. And you can see that when you compare the situation in the U.S. and in Europe. In several European countries, there is an intense and productive interplay between social movements, trade unions, and leftist parties, instead of the old splits and animosities. There are more and more relations of mutual reinforcement. And this applies, for instance, to Spain, where the Occupy movement of the Indignados strongly influences the strategy of the trade unions. In the meantime, the trade unions became much more combative and militant. It also reactivated the membership of the leftist party coalition Izquierda Unida, which, on the other hand, opened its electoral lists for movement activists and more than doubled its electoral votes. And in Greece especially, we can see that there were for a long time strong and combative social movements organizing huge demonstrations against the imposed austerity politics with no direct impact, however, until the leftist party coalition Syriza succeeded in assembling the impulses of the movements into a coherent political alternative, which, as you mentioned, garnered 27% in the last elections in June 2012. And now, according to the polls, has even more, about 30%. So social movements and leftist parties have learned from each other. The parties do not longer claim to represent the movement, but define themselves as more or less connective parties. And more activists in the movement understand that they need allies in the parliamentary system as well. and that a general refusal of party politics helps only the most conservative and reactionary parties.
Yeah, because they're left alone since the alternatives stay out of the political arena.
Exactly, yeah.
So your argument is it is a limit of Occupy not to have explored or pursued or opened itself to some attempts at least at a creative political formation project as well.
Yes, it has not mustered the will and the capacity so far to initiate its own autonomous progressive organization of a new type, based on networks, based on radical democracy and so on, a kind of connective party, which doesn't mean necessarily an electoral party. And I think this is one of the reasons why it was not possible so far to transform Occupy Wall Street's momentary disruption of neoliberal hegemony into a more sustainable, lasting counter-hegemony.
All right, this is wonderful. Now, let's take it the next step. One of the most persistent criticisms of Occupy Wall Street, both when it was in its heyday of exploding onto the American scene and getting the kind of mass support that your poll numbers show, and then later when it had ebbed in terms of its surging importance in America, one of the most consistent criticisms was, what was its program? Or it didn't articulate a clear program, as if a movement has from the very beginning to have all the answers to how to proceed. Without going to that extreme and rehearsing that criticism, which I think was pretty well refuted and pushed away, there is still the question, are there concrete or tangible ways that you think Occupy might translate all that it achieved into a more lasting impact? You've mentioned the political formation, but are there positive goals it could articulate, and what might they be to give itself even greater impact and to create a lasting framework?
Yeah. So I'm not advocating a new laundry list of demands. That's not my point. But just let me take this one example. The the claim of radical direct democracy and consensus principle is one of the characteristics of Occupy Wall Street, and I think it was a very important experience. But on the other hand, I think it should not be idolized as the only way to go. These are valuable starting points, but they need to be translated. They need to be concretized into projects of economic democracy. In my understanding, Occupy Wall Street is already a movement for economic democracy because it articulates,
certainly includes that. Yes.
It expresses the fundamental contradiction between democracy and capitalism. But it does not work. It has not yet worked on economic democracy in an explicit way. And I think it would be good to do that. The concept
well,
of...
Let me interrupt you, Jan, because I work on this, as you know. I also was struck with the enormous energy and creativity and originality of their demands for democratic ways of, for example, of disposing of park space in a city, of disposing of the entire urban landscape. They tied beautifully into the right to the city and all that, movements that want a democratic way to shape the political life of the community. The interesting question then becomes, doesn't that partner logically with a demand for democratically controlling the workplace too, and not just the residential or urban space within which workplaces occur?
Yes, in my view, this is a crucial kind of
next step.
Yes, a key question. I think without economic democracy, there's no real political democracy in society. Without economic democracy, there's no way to overcome the wild chase for profit that determines and alienates our lives. Without economic democracy, there's no chance for an ecological transformation, because an ecological transformation only becomes real if we really change the way we produce, what we produce, how we consume.
And what drives our productive decisions.
Exactly. And so One of the advantages of the concept of economic democracy is that it drew the lessons of both state, bureaucratic state socialism in Eastern Europe and Western social democracy in the West, because both of them did not change the fundamental power relations in the workplace. They did not build up workers' self-directed enterprises. And I think it's no wonder that economic democracy is such a taboo in capitalist ideologies. It is more carefully hidden, more carefully evaded than most of the sexual taboos, right, even in America. And I think we need to break this taboo and create a new and appealing alternative project of democratic and ecological socialism. And I think that spelling out, concretizing economic democracy is a key element to redefine what such an alternative could look like.
Wonderful conclusion to a discussion of Occupy, since you're basically arguing that Occupy Wall Street took a major step in precisely that direction, and that one of the ways to honor that step is to take it another step. And in a sense, you've suggested where that could go. Jan, I wish, as always, that we had more time. Let's do this again in the future. Thank you very, very much for sharing your Gramscian analysis with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to an excerpt from the program Economic Update with host Richard Wolf. He spoke with Professor Jan Rehman about his analysis of the Occupy movement, which is based on the work of the Italian theorist Antonio Gramsci. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. The time is 9:27. Coming up at 9:30 on Political Perspectives, your host Andrew Geller speaks with Kelly Mitchell, a coal campaigner with Greenpeace, about their new report, Point of No Return, which describes 14 new coal, methane, and oil developments which, if built, will eliminate our opportunity to prevent catastrophic climate change.
Hi, this is Love Jones, producer and DJ for The Confessional. I'm so pleased to invite you to join us on Valentine's Day, February 14th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, a benefit for KBOO. It's going to be an amazing night filled with sing-alongs, contests, a live performance by La Contessa de la Luna herself, and of course, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, Rear Window. This is your opportunity to redeem Valentine's Day. Join us February 14th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater of 26th and Clinton in Southeast Portland for La Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Day Spectacular.
This is Contessa de la Luna inviting you to join us live at the Clinton Street Theater on Valentine's Day. Kiss, kiss.
Hello, my name is Andrew Geller. I'm here for KBOO Radio. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2013, and I'm going to be spending the half hour talking about among my most favorite and sometimes least favorite topics to talk about on the radio, and that is our global climate and the changes that we are causing. It was 25 years ago this year that James Hansen testified before Congress, alerting the world to the very real threat of global warming and climate change. In a paper he published just after the testimony before Congress, he made three predictions regarding possible future global temperature change regarding or resulting from the forcing of carbon in the atmosphere that we people have been doing over the course of the last century and more. A, B, and C, high, medium, and low. And 25 years on, it turns out that scenario B, which nobody should underestimate, seeing as it's not the high prediction, scenario B has tracked, or I should say reality has tracked most closely with scenario B, and there has been nothing tangible done to reduce global carbon emissions. yes, there have been efforts, but the pace of change or the pace of carbon emissions into the atmosphere has not only maintained in the last couple of years, it has peaked at new annual change record levels. Joining me today to talk about 14 proposed coal, methane, and oil projects around the world, I have from Greenpeace, Kelly Mitchell. She is a coal campaigner, and the report Greenpeace recently put out, called Point of No Return, looks at these 14 projects and states that if built, they will eliminate the possibility for us to avoid catastrophic climate change. So welcome to KBOO's Airwaves, Kelly.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. Happy to be here.
Now, the report Point of No Return, as I mentioned, talks about these 14 projects around the world. They are very coal heavy, but there is significant impact from the methane and oil projects. Before we dive deeply into looking at those, and more specifically the U.S. component, because there's a local perspective here in Portland and Oregon, I want you to set a little context for us regarding where we are in terms of carbon in the atmosphere, a little generality about what these projects, in terms of the numbers of, say, gigatons of coal and temperature predictions related to them. Little context about the report, if you would.
Absolutely. So I think 2012 was a year where the reality of the climate crisis really hit home, I think especially for folks here in the United States. If you look at what's happened with Hurricane Sandy, with the continuing record droughts that are happening throughout the Midwest, and even news coming out of Australia right now, where they were facing unprecedented heat waves and wildfires, immediately followed by record flooding that's continuing to threaten lives and livelihoods.